Good morning. Good morning. So, welcome. Welcome back. Welcome to those of you who are here for the first time. I know this happens at Holden. People are coming and going every day, and so I'll try to do a little bit to try to catch people up. Good news about we've had two sibling rivalries so far from the book of Genesis. We have three to go. The good news is the stories get better. They just get juicier and juicier and juicier. And the rest of the news is that they get longer. So I'm going to beg your indulgence as we kind of sample. And all along, I've made no claims of being comprehensive. There are a gazillion ways these stories can be read. There's a reason they have lived for millennia. But I do hope that there'll be enough to catch the continuity as well as to provoke your thinking. I started the first day we discovered that the firstborns were, shall we say, very well represented in the room. And so yesterday I started with a nod toward youngest children. Youngest children are wonderful, playful, delightful people in the world. And today I want to start with a nod toward the middle children in families. Our pastor preached the prodigal son. The last time he preached the prodigal son, he did it with birth order discussion, and the middle children came out of church and said, "Right, we were forgotten again."
What else is new?
Well, our middle daughter's name is Anna, and she is wonderful. I've got a fun story about her for tomorrow. But when she was growing up, we had this great little children's book that said, "The best things are in the middle." And it started with peanut butter and jelly. And it moved on to double Oreos. And the whole book was this kind of Goldilocks approach, where some things are too hard and some things are too soft or too cold or too hot, but the middle is just right. So middle children, we love you. All right?
Even though we're very underrepresented.
You are underrepresented. Although, you know, when we get to the Joseph story, there will be a lot of middle children. Jacob was prolific. So what we're doing in this is listening for the way the Bible uses sibling stories to tell the story of the world. I mean, I think mostly when we get along with our siblings or not, we don't necessarily see ourselves doing something cosmic, something of cosmic importance. And when we're facing cosmic global issues, we don't face them, I think, with the same urgency that we do with our intimate relationships. But the Bible is going to hold them together. They're going to make all of these stories a story about siblings, about family, no matter how violent or intense the story gets. So I've tried to be careful that we not get political too soon, but it's going to happen. It's going to happen today. So, you know, I told you as I prepared the class, everybody I said what I was going to do, they had a sibling story. We have one of the great gifts of our lives is that we have these lifelong friends, Jim and Deanne. They live two doors from us when in our second parish. And Susan and Deanne were pregnant at the same time, were godparents for their son, Alex, who signed this document. And so we went from being pregnant, and our kids went to the same college, and we sat together at their college graduation. You know, it was just so wonderful. So we were out for dinner with Jim and Deanne, and I'm telling them what I'm working on. And Deanne had been going through boxes of stuff, calling out the basement, you know, what people in their 50s are supposed to do, right? And commenting about how many outrageous cards I had sent them over the years, which are now history. She had discarded those, but she said, "I did keep the deal." I said, "Well, do tell, what's the deal?" Well, when Adam was the older brother in this family, you can't really see this. This is just a screen or a cell phone picture of the deal, so I wrote it there. And Adam was about 7, and Alex was about 4. And Adam scrawled this deal that said, "I will leave the house when Adam has friends, girls, over. 3 full days at the park, I will not go if Adam does." So here, I mean, we're going to talk about Jacob talking Esau out of his birthright, right? So here, Alex has to sign off on his right to go to the park if he doesn't leave the house when Adam has girls over, and Alex duly signed it. So, I mean, now that we have a deal maker as president, one of the things I've heard back from a number of people is the family issues and the national issues are closer together. And all I'm going to say about that for the moment is there was this great cartoon in Christian Century just before Thanksgiving, obviously. And it's of a woman setting the Thanksgiving table, and the plates were labeled, and every other one said, Clinton, Trump, Clinton, Trump, Clinton, around the dining room table, all right? How we deal with our relatives has cosmic implications. I'm convinced of it. Psychologists will say that, I said this yesterday, how we're formed by our family of origin is how we live out who we are in all kinds. And so to look at this, I mean, the Bible clearly is saying this is perfectly valid. So quick catch up for those of you who are new. The first day we started in the middle with the conflict between Ishmael and Isaac, which is in fact a conflict between Sarah and Hagar. And at the moment at which Sarah is banishing Hagar and Ishmael from the house. And we read the two chapters side by side, the sacrifice of Ishmael and then the sacrifice of Isaac, and compared that. And we're amazed at the way the story of Hagar and Ishmael, the text says Abram was deeply distressed. It does not say that when God tells him to go sacrifice Isaac. It's much more a matter of fact telling of the story. This deep sympathy that gets evoked for Ishmael. And our guide in this is Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who's written the book, Not in God's Name. And his term for what is happening there is counter-narrative. So the narrative is that Isaac is chosen, but the counter-narrative is that Ishmael is not unchosen. Okay, that God still hears Ishmael. God sustains Hagar and Ishmael. What's really amazing about this story is that the story is being narrated by Isaac and Isaac's descendants. But it's telling the story of this half-brother very charitably and compassionately. And so as we push ourselves toward interfaith implications, one of the things I propose we could learn is to tell the stories of the other compassionately, sympathetically, from their point of view. I think that has implications in our family, and I know it has implications in the world. Yesterday, we dealt with Cain and Abel to kind of work with where do these violent impulses come from, and how do we make sense of the fact that they happen in families. And we used Cain and Abel as an example of what Sacks does in his evolutionary research to talk about the power of cooperation in evolution. He asserts that cooperation is essential to survival. So the most cooperative will survive. We need to cooperate to survive, and cooperation needs trust. Cooperation and trust builds groups. But therefore, where violence? Well, violence comes from loyalty to groups being threatened by other groups. So we tend to live our groupishness. He will say the source of violence in the world is our groupishness. And then we use, so Cain and Abel, in terms of groupishness, Cain is a tiller of the field and Abel is a keeper of flocks. And we can know historically on a number of levels that there are conflicts between killers and herders, tillers, tillers and herders. And then the next thing you know, they're killers. You know, So we use that as an example to think about dualism in the world. And as Sacks develops what he is calling a radical monotheism, by which he means we hold the good and bad in a single God. All right? We wrestle this out with God, as opposed to a dualism which pushes it over there. Us them thinking is the source of violence, is what he's saying. So us, the question here is how to build a bigger us and how to become aware of this so that we don't fall into pathological dualism, which Gary and I are both concerned could be happening in the United States. A pathological dualism is going to put all the negative on them, is going to see self as victim, and then is going to justify what Sachs calls altruistic violence. So doing violence in the name of God. Within the Christian community, we can see this when violence is enacted on abortion clinics, right? We're against killing, but we're willing to kill people who are practicing abortion. And that is a huge contradiction. But it comes out of this dualistic kind of thinking, so we're moving more toward monotheism. So every day I've invited you to just think some about your... I tried to put a verse up that I think is really remarkable from the story we're considering. Is that when we get into the Jacob story, you will appreciate again how remarkable this is. That Jacob bows to the ground 7 times before Esau, and they rush and embrace and weep and kiss each other. And I invited you, I tried to give the prompt the day before, to think about moments of reconciliation that you may have had, or astonishing gifts from your siblings. I realized when I was thinking about this in bed, waking up this morning, that I could have asked this, the astonishing gifts you may have given your siblings, moments that you felt moved to give this overwhelming, generous gift. And what preceded that? What went ahead of that? Either the reconciliation or an astonishing gift. So just take a few minutes to talk about that. Then we're going to dive into this amazing text. So go ahead. When do you remember receiving astonishing gifts from yourself? Okay. Try you back. Hello. Hello. The Lord be with you. Good morning. Good morning. I have good news. Good news is coffee break is coming. So you obviously have more stories to tell, and that's good. I mostly just want to open this up so that you've invested yourself a bit. Any examples? Any quick examples somebody got? One they're willing to share with the group? I can tell you that my brother has become a potter, and he's very good. And he's very generous with his pottery. It's really a beautiful thing. And I think it's important for me, when I think about who he is and who we are together, for me to think about what precedes that. Because there have been some other ways that I experience him as not so generous. Did you?
Yeah, when I was about 33, I was between jobs for about almost a year. And I become unemployed in June and was living off savings, and at Christmas, my younger brother, who was 30, gave me a joint checking account that he had just opened in our names and said there was money in there to pay my utilities for the rest of the year.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow. Wow.
Any others? We can take time for one more. Go ahead.
My mother was very difficult, and I lived in Seattle. Mom and Dave lived in Portland. Okay, so Dave got the brunt of it. Then Dave's son spent a year in prison, and Dave got involved with Alan. I got the most heartfelt, profuse apology I'll ever get in my entire life. I'm so sorry that I tried to make my siblings do what I did for mom.
Thank you for sharing that. One of the other teachers said to me, you know, he uses the term Hebrew Bible. I continue to use the word Old Testament because I know from a Jewish scholar that the Hebrew Bible is ordered in a different order than the Old Testament, and that matters. Mm-hmm. And so while they are similar books and they have a common source, there are differences between them. But what I'm getting at is he said the Old Testament isn't old. And as we walk through this week, one of the things I'm aware of is that, you know, we sometimes have arguments over whether these things really happened. It's the wrong argument. They still happen. And what you just shared with us is a marvelous example of what I see happening between Jacob and Esau. And the beauty of the breadth and depth and intricacy of the story is that we get to trace some of the steps of how they got there. And that is, after all, what we all want, that, the apology, the reconciliation in our families and in our world. But the whole question about how do we get there and what do we do? So we're going to start in Genesis 25. And I will start with verse 21, because the Hebrew names in 19 and 20 are absolutely impossible. So how's that for self-interest? Okay, so chapter 25, verse 21. Isaac, one of the things that we will really discover the next 3 days is recurring themes. I mean, we've seen these themes, and they just keep coming back and back and back. Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren. Okay, chapter 2, right? Sarah was barren. We've heard that before. And the Lord granted his prayer, and his wife Rebekah conceived. The children struggled together within her. And she said, if it is to be this way, why do I live? Now, if we had all week to work on this, I would let women who have been pregnant talk about what movement is like within. I don't know, but I'd listen. So she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples born of you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other. The elder shall serve the younger. We haven't made a lot of this, but one of the other themes that will become really prominent is that the chosen one in these stories is not necessarily the strong. In fact, is not the strongest. Ishmael is called a wild ass of a man, and he's a warrior, and Isaac is much meeker. And the same is going to be true between Esau and Jacob. The word religion means to connect. It's from the same word as ligament. It's all about connection. And I finally think religious discussions come down to how we understand power. And another whole approach to this can be to say, what is powerful? Is it force and brute strength, or is there another kind of power going on? And that's going to be very important in this story. But we got the birth order thing again. We've got the reversal of birth order. With the elder serving the younger. All of this is kind of an interpretation of what's coming. When her time to give birth was at hand, there were twins in her womb. The first came out red, all his body like a hairy mantle. So they named him Esau, which means red. Afterward, his brother came out with his hand gripping Esau's heel. So he was named Jacob, which means grabber or usurper. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man, living in tents. You see the way this characterization is drawn? I mean, what do we see as powerful? And what's going to come of this? And now the verse. This was the verse I thought about doing for your own family prompt, but I decided most of you are on vacation. You don't necessarily need to think about this on vacation. Yeah. Isaac loved Esau because he was fond of game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. I think it's one of the most tragic verses in the Bible. I really do. And at the same time, it's really important. And I'm sure we have stories of times that whether or not it actually happened between our parents, that we felt like it was happening, and that this sort of... So one of the questions becomes, is what's happening here a conflict between Jacob and Esau, or is it a conflict between Isaac and Rebekah? And as we read along, Rebekah's going to be very involved. Before we get there, I'm going to already move to one of the insights that I think is just really profound from Rabbi Sacks. He develops a scapegoating theory in the book. And as a Jewish theologian, he plays it out with Nazi Germany in great detail. It's well worth reading. And his thesis is that scapegoating is not about the third party. It's not about the person who gets the violence. In the case of Germany, then it's not about the Jews. It's about the tension within the dominant community. And so the tension within post-World War I Germany is what set up the scapegoating, needing to find somebody to blame for. Yesterday we heard him say a dualism is when the distance between reality as it is and reality as it should be becomes unbearable. And then this becomes a way it gets acted out. So one of the things I think we see in this story between Isaac and Rebecca is that there's a tension between the parents, and it gets acted out. We asked the question yesterday, what is sibling rivalry about? One of the things we're going to hear again in this story is that it's about differentiation in a way. It's about finding our sense of self as over, where does self stop and the other start? One of the other things I think it's about is parental issues that get played out in the next generation. Gary's been talking about what 10 and 12-year-old children can absorb. And I mean, we're going to see that happening in this story. But I was just stunned because the date of this newspaper, I always have to keep track of my light. This is USA Today, a cover story from November 21st, Monday, November 21st last year. And the article was about the polarization in the United States. And so to reflect on the polarization we're experiencing now in the United States, they asked three historians to comment on other historical times that the United States is polarized. And the three episodes that are discussed in this article, I'm happy to share this article at coffee, but I'm not going to read the whole thing, are the right after the Civil War, the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., and the resignation of Richard Nixon. The times that there was deep polarization. But let me just read for you how the article starts. The Old Testament is not old. Even a cursory look at a U.S. electoral map shows a striking red-blue divide that in most cases separates big cities and coastal areas from the rest of America. As angry protesters rage in the streets, one can easily conclude that we've never been so irreconcilably divided. But this is nothing new. Throughout our history, we have, of course, found ourselves at odds again and again. So how have we healed the wounds that divided the nation in the past? To look into this question, USA Today asked three historians to consider times when the USA was torn apart by bitter politics, assassinations, and even war, and how we bridged the deep divisions. We chose two recent moments, both within the past 50 years and a cataclysmic moment from more than 150 years ago. All three historians made the case that, at least in the instances we chose, the USA didn't so much heal as figure out a way to pass the pain on to others in the name of healing. I can hardly believe it. You know, I've been working on this study at this point for probably 3 or 4 months. And there it was. Even as cataclysmic events came to their official end, aftershocks and adjustments followed, sometimes in violence, sometimes in votes. And in their own ways, all three movements reveal that we're still coming to terms with the issues laid bare, from racial violence and racially based resentment to distrust of government and conflicts over angry free speech versus law and order. So we found it's a fascinating article. And it just demonstrates a number of things that we're trying to assert here, that that the patterns keep happening and that the conflicts get played out in other places, and he has this scapegoating theory. Well, let's see how it plays out for Jacob and Esau. Okay, so we will move to chapters 27 and 28. Where Isaac blesses, first disguised Jacob. We'll start right at verse 1, because we'll also be able to see here how much the parents are involved and how this plays out. When Isaac was old and his eyes were dim so that he could not see, he called his elder son Esau and said to him, "My son," and he answered, "Here I am." He said, "See, I'm old. I do not know the day of my death. Now then, take your weapons, your quiver, and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me. Then prepare for me savory food, such as I like, and bring it to me so that I may bless you before I die. Now Rebekah was listening when Isaac spoke to his son Esau. So when Esau went to the field to hunt for game and bring it, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, I heard your father say to your brother Esau, bring me game and prepare for me savory food to eat that I may bless you before the Lord, before I die. Now therefore, my son, obey my word as I command you. Go to the flock and get me two choice kids so that I may prepare from them savory food for your father, such as he likes. And you shall take it to your father to eat so that he may bless you before he dies. But Jacob said to his mother Rebekah, look, my brother Esau is a hairy man and I'm a man of smooth skin. Perhaps my father will feel me and I shall seem to be mocking him, bring a curse on myself and not a blessing. His mother said to him, let your curse be on me, my son. Only obey my word and go get them for me. So he went and got them, brought them to his mother, and his mother prepared savory food, such as his father loved. Then Rebekah took the best garments of her elder son, Esau, which were with her in the house, and put them on her younger son, Jacob. She put the skins of the kids on his hands and on the smooth part of his neck. Then she handed the savory food and the bread that she had prepared to her son, Jacob. So he went into his father and said, my father, and he said, here I am. Who are you, my son? Jacob said to his father, I'm Esau, your firstborn. I've done as you told me. Now sit up and eat of my game so that you may bless me. But Isaac said to his son, how is it that you have found it so quickly, my son? He answered, because the Lord your God granted me success. One of the other things that Zach said that I absolutely love is that it's not that religion becomes violent, it's that violence becomes religious. You know?
Yeah.
How did this all work out? Well, I prayed about it. Oh.
Sounds like Red Riding Hood.
Yeah, don't you think? So the Lord God granted me success. Then Isaac said to Jacob, come near that I may feel you, my son, to know whether you are really my son Esau or not. So Jacob went up to his father Isaac, who felt him and said, the voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau. He did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him. He said, are you really my son Esau? He answered, I am. Then he said, bring it to me that I may eat of my son's game and bless you. So he brought it to him and he ate and he thought, he brought him wine and he drank. Then his father Isaac said to him, come near and kiss me, my son. So he came near and kissed him. And Isaac smelled the smell of his garments, and he blessed him and said, ah, the smell of my son is like the smell of a field that the Lord has blessed. May God give you the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and plenty of grain and wine. Let people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be Lord over your brothers. And may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be everyone who blesses you. We're going to come back to this. There's lots to say about this, but I want to get the rest of the story in front of us. As soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, when Jacob had scarcely gone out from the presence of his father Isaac, his brother Esau came in from his hunting. He also prepared savory food and brought it to his father, and he said to his father, let my father sit up and eat of his son's game so that you may bless me. His father Isaac said to him, who are you? He answered, I am your firstborn son Esau. Then Isaac trembled violently and said, who was it then that hunted game and brought it to me? And I ate it all before you came, and I have blessed him. Yes, and blessed he shall be. When Esau heard his father's words, he cried out with an exceedingly great and bitter cry and said to his father, bless me also, father. But he said, your brother came deceitfully, and he has taken away your blessing. Esau said, is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and look, now he has taken away my blessing. Then he said, have you not reserved a blessing for me? Isaac answered Esau, I have already made him your lord, and I have already given him all his brothers as servants, and with grain and wine I have sustained him. What then can I do for you, my son? Esau said to his father, have you only one blessing, father? Bless me also, father. And Esau lifted up his voice and wept. Then his father answered him, "See, away from the fatness of the earth shall your home be, and away from the dew of heaven on high. By your sword you shall live, and you shall serve your brother. But when you shall break loose, you shall break his yoke from your neck." Now Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are approaching, then I will kill my brother Jacob." But the words of her elder son Esau were told to Rebekah. So she sent and called her younger son Jacob and said to him, "Your brother Esau is consoling himself by planning to kill you. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice. Flee at once to my brother Laban in Haran and stay with him a while until your brother's fury turns away. Tell your brother's anger against you turns away and he forgets what you have done to him. Then I will send and bring you back from there. Why should I lose both of you in one day?" Then Rebekah said to Isaac, "I am weary of my life because of the Hittite women. If Jacob marries one of the Hittite women," put it on the Hittites, right? "If Jacob marries one of the Hittite women such as these, one of the women of the land, what good will my life be to me?" Then Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him, "You shall not marry one of the Canaanite women. Go at once back to Paddan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and take a wife from one of the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. May God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and numerous, that you may become a company of peoples. May he give you the blessing of Abram to you and to your offspring with you, so that you may take possession of the land where you now live as an alien, land that God gave up to Abraham." Thus Isaac sent Jacob away, and he went to Paddan Aram to Laban, son of Bethuel the Aramean, the brother of Rebekah, Jacob and Esau's mother. Okay, so the story is fraught, is it not?
Yes.
With conflict and with irony. That, you know, there's all this foreshadowing that happens. So already God says to Rebekah, you know, two nations are in your womb, and the younger shall serve the older. And then Isaac unwittingly blesses the younger and says, "You shall rule over your brother." Right? So this has already happened. There's this tension, and it's rooted in dishonesty, in disguise. I mean, we're going to give that, what we call it makes all the difference. But the other thing that we can hear here is that there is this huge tension about what kind of power is being unleashed. So the first blessing Isaac gives Jacob, when Isaac thinks that Jacob is Esau, is all about wealth and power. "May God give you the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth and plenty of grain and wine. The people serve you and the nations bow down to you." This is very economic and political, right? And then when Isaac knows that Jacob is Jacob, he gives a very different kind of blessing. That blessing, which was in chapter 28, is, "May God Almighty bless you, make you fruitful and numerous." It's about descendants and children. "May he give to you the blessing of Abram, to you and your offering." It's about blessing, okay? It's all the talk that we've had about Abram and Sarah from the beginning. So there's this tension set up in these two blessings about what kind of power, not only which brother is going to prevail, it gets acted out between the brothers, but what kind of power is going to prevail. And Isaac, although he doesn't really bless Esau, he does have these words to him to say, you know, the Hebrews have this great view of the power of language, that once it's spoken, it cannot be taken back, and it is going to happen. So they're very cautious with both blessing and curse, because when it's spoken, it's out there. And I think that's more true, honestly, than the way we treat language. I mean, we curse all the time and say, "Well, I don't mean it." But the language still does what it does. And I think it diminishes more than we admit. But Isaac has these words for Esau about Esau's kind of power. Esau's got the sword. That's in verse 40. "By your sword you shall live, and you shall serve your brother. When you break loose, you shall break the yoke from his neck." So here again is this foreshadowing, that Esau's going to be bound by this, but it's going to break loose. And our question is, how is that going to happen? What needs to happen for that to happen? So, reactions, discussions, stories of, please.
I hate the story.
Okay.
And the reason I hate it is that the parents are divided. They have favorites.
Yeah.
They don't talk. And how hard would it be for them to say, hey, how do we make sure that both twins get what they need? And why is there one blessing that's so, it's pride. It means somebody wins and somebody loses. And why would you do that to your children, especially if they're twins?
Yeah.
Because one is, 3 minutes older than the other, or not even that. So it makes me angry. And I see it as being also a separation between men and women. They don't talk.
No.
And it means that Sarah is also inferior. She's probably pissed off. And so then she chooses her favorite son to get back at her husband for wielding power. It's fraught. And it's not just siblings, like you say, it's husband and wife, but it's also male and female. And I want the whole story to get rewritten.
Good. Good for you. And a great, insightful interpretation. And so what I want to say back to you, and this great, insightful comment, is to think about that we're not only working on family systems here, we're working on cosmic questions. Mm-hmm. And how hard is it for the world to see to it that everybody gets what they need? Mm-hmm. Is that not the question that's being dealt with in session after session this week? How hard is it for the world to see that everybody gets what they need? And how hard is it for religious people, of all people, to share with others and to exchange gifts and to see to it that everybody gets what they need? You know, other great start. Are there any other reactions? Go ahead.
Talk about fake news. How ironic is it in this day that someone comes to power through deceit and it can't be undone?
How ironic is it in this day that somebody comes to power through deceit? A very valid comment. I'm going to tell you, we're going to have to skip the funniest part of the story because otherwise we just absolutely wouldn't get done. This story is also full of humor, which I love and which we need because it's so intense. So I'll tell a funny modern day story. I went to my 40th class reunion and it was hosted by our class bully. So I was bullied seriously in high school. I am small of stature and I was an easy target, and besides that I was a curve wrecker in the classroom, right? So there you go. And I don't need to tell the whole story, but there was this one marvelous moment in the evening. This guy has built this business in this little town out of my hometown, and so they cooked a marvelous meal for us, and I was sitting across the table from one of my classmates and her husband, and I barely know her husband, but I know this classmate very well. And so the former bully, we'll give him that much grace, was coming around the room seeing if we'd enjoyed our meal and talking to us. And so then he starts in on this long, typical class reunion speech about how he never expected to make this much money, blah, 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 blah. And you're sitting there fuming, wanting the story to be rewritten. My classmate's husband, sitting across the table, very gently said, "And are you happy?" It was a moment. It was a moment. The power of a question, gently asked, "And are you happy?" What power do we lean on, and how do we learn to lean into the kind of power we want? And then, he started talking about his son. I mean, it was exactly a reflection of these two blessings of Jacob, where the first one is about my wealth and my power and my influence, and then when the word happy came into the conversation, it shifted, this marvelous shift. I mean, one of the interesting things, I take my students to New York, that stymies them is that people in the soup kitchen seem to have more fun than the people they meet on the street. The people they meet on the street are dressed to the nines, and they are appropriate, and they strut, and they're terse, and you know they don't make eye contact. But the people in the soup kitchen know each other. They sort of like hold on. You know, they have time to talk to each other. And there's this delight there. Well, what power are we going to choose, my friends? And what powers function in our families and why? And then what effect does that have on the world? So the term that I want to introduce you to from Sachs is mimetic desire. It's from the word mimesis, which means imitation. Often it leads, and it comes right out of the story, of course, because Jacob pretends to be Esau, wants to be Esau, and wants what rightfully belongs to Esau, his father's blessing. And so there is this imitation at the center of the story. And the question that for all of us that comes is when do we pretend to be something we are not? And at Holden, we have the freedom to make that a religious question. We're children of God, and we believe that all others are children of God. But why do we pretend to be other than that? And what's going to happen in the story to kind of shift that? I think I've got another slide. The key words of Jacob's story, face, name, and blessing, are all about identity. Jacob wanted to be Esau. To receive that blessing, Jacob did not have to dress in Esau's clothes. Instead, he had to be himself. Well, the rest of this, we need to read the rest of the story before this makes sense. So any other comments before we move along?
Yeah, I think this is just an observation and a frustration around this the moment of blessing. And so I'm thinking about the power of language. And I'm a medical interpreter, and so the observation is that I have seen, I interpret for West Africans in the Philadelphia area prior to coming to Holden. And for many people from rural areas, when providers would start reading all of the possibilities of risks, and including the possibility of death for somebody about to go into labor and needs an epidural, I mean, I saw the anxiety rise in this woman's eyes, because it was as if what the provider was saying was bringing closer to reality these things. Mm-hmm. So, and on the other hand, I'm thinking, you know, this is a moment of blessing, and it's being limited. You know, his question, you know, is, do you only have one blessing?
Yeah.
And so I find myself feeling like there's this power, but it's also limiting something that there could or should be in abundance. Yeah. And I wonder, so I don't know, it's just kind of a tension.
I think that it is a tension. I also think that is a tension reflected between the two blessings. That the way power is described in the first, where it's wealth, that is limited resources, scarce resources. We've talked about sibling rivalry, competing for parents' attention. Is parents' attention scarce? Parents' affection scarce? But the second one, about generosity and blessing, I mean, the land, of course, is another deal. The land belongs to someone or not to someone. I mean, there have been cultures that believe the land couldn't ever be possessed.
Right.
And we want to listen to that too. But it's a very important tension.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. Okay, so just to, if we made Jacob and Esau the whole course, we would get to read the way Jacob then starts tricking Laban. Because tomorrow we're going to read about Rachel and Leah. So we'll get some more of the middle of the story. But while he's in the house of Laban, he comes up with this great scheme. It's just hilarious, where he's trying to talk to Laban about what should be his salary, because he's worked so hard for Laban. And so he proposes that he gets the spotted and striped livestock, all right? And then he devises this breeding method where he takes a rod and he carves the bark off it so that it's striped. And when the strong stock come to breed, he holds it in front of them, and they produce striped and spotted offspring. And when the weak ones come, he doesn't. So then those are Laban's. And so then he's getting the, you know what people say, when you get old, you're the same as you always were, only more so. And one of the things, I have a friend, a scholar of family systems, the textbook of which is called Generation to Generation. I mean, we're only talking this week really about our siblings. But this becomes an even more interesting discussion when we talk about our parents and their siblings and what themes we see repeated generation to generation. And the thing that the text is bearing out here is that Laban doesn't change, or that Jacob doesn't change until he changes. He just keeps being Jacob. And he keeps getting into trouble for it. And so then Laban's servants are upset. Because, I mean, the thing that's frustrating about Jacob is that is not only is he a bully and dishonest and a cheater and all of that, but he's successful. Uh-huh. Right? Well, this is also a frustration we feel in the world, is it not? And so then Jacob flees the house of Laban. And that's where we're going to pick up the story now. But do read it. It's really very fun. That's in chapters 30 and 31. We'll go to 33 now. Actually, I wanted to start a little earlier than that. Okay, we're going to start at 32, verse 3. So Jacob is leaving the house of Laban now, and he's coming back. And I'm going to, see, I will start with 32, verse 3. Jacob sent messengers before him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom, instructing them, "Thus you shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have lived with Laban as an alien and stayed until now, and I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, male and female slaves, and I have sent to tell my lord in order that I might find favor in your sight." Hear any irony in this? What's he calling his brother? My lord, that I might find favor in your sight. The messengers returned to Jacob saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and he is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him." D-D-D-D. The story is going to turn. Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. And he divided the people that were with him and the flocks and the herds and the camels into two companies, thinking, "If Esau comes to one company and destroys it, then the company that is left will escape." Okay? Cutting his losses, right? 400 men couldn't possibly destroy more than half of what I've got. And Jacob said, "O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord who said to me, 'Return to your country and to your kindred, and I will do you good. I am not worthy of the least of all the steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. For with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, please, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I am afraid of him. He may come and kill us all, the mothers with the children. Yet you have said, 'I will surely do you good, and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted because of their number.'" So he spent the night there, and from what he had said with him, he took a present for his brother Esau, 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milk cows and their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. Then he delivered into the hand of his servants every drove by itself and said to his servants, "Pass on ahead of me and put a space between drove and drove." He instructed the foremost, "When Esau, my brother, meets you and asks you, 'To whom do you belong? Where are you going? And who are these ahead of you?' Then you shall say, 'These belong to your servant Jacob. They are a present sent to my lord Esau, and moreover, he is behind us.' He likewise instructed the second and the third and all who followed the droves. You shall say the same thing to Esau when you meet him, and you shall say, 'Moreover, your servant Jacob is behind us.' For he thought, 'I may appease him with the present that goes ahead of me, and afterward I shall see his face, perhaps he will accept me.' So the present passed on ahead of him, and he himself spent that night in his camp." Okay, who is Jacob struggling with? Is it Esau?
His guilt.
How many of you think he's struggling with Esau? How many of you think he's struggling with himself? I mean, it's a similar kind of speech, right? I never expected to make so much money, you know, counting it and this extravagant. I mean, it would be extravagant even in our day.
He's looking at the world through his prism.
Do you think? Yeah.
And that's what resonates with
him. Yeah, now let's think about mimetic desire, about pretense, about pretending to be something that you aren't. Do you think is he true yet, or is he still pretending? Your servant Jacob, my Lord Esau. Do you trust that?
Okay.
No, so, you know, what needs to happen for the world to move? I mean, it's starting to happen. It's starting to move. You can see that it's things are catching up with him. And tomorrow, when we read the Jacob or the Rachel and Leah stories, we're going to hear some comeuppance. I mean, some real life has happened for Jacob. And it's a what's this telling
you?
You're going to lose power.
Somehow that power's not plugged in.
It wouldn't be and I mean, what kind of blessing do I need to pray for here? That I still have power. Thank you.
You got power.
Yeah, good.
But it's diminished before you could claim it.
Yeah, there you go. A little foreshadowing over here from the fellow pastor. Any other comments about this? Okay, quickly. We're getting so close to time, I'm sorry. Verse 22. That same night, Jacob got up and took his two wives, his two maids, and his 11 children and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream and likewise everything that he had. Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he struck him on the hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, "Let me go, for the day is breaking." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." Then the man said, "You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with humans and have prevailed." Then Jacob asked him, "Please tell me your name." But he said, "Why is it that you ask my name?" And there he blessed him. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, saying, "For I have seen God face to face, and yet my life is preserved." The sun rose upon him as he passed Peniel, limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, Israelites do not eat the thigh muscle that is on the hip socket, because he struck Jacob on the hip socket at the thigh muscle. Now Jacob looked up and saw Esau coming and 400 men with him. So he divided his children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids. He put the maids with their children in front. Then Leah went with her children, and Rachel and Joseph last of all. He himself went on ahead of them, bowing himself to the ground 7 times until he came near his brother. But Esau ran to meet him and embraced him, fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. When Esau looked up and saw the women and children, he said, "Who are these with you?" Jacob said, "The children whom God has graciously given your servant." Then the maids drew near, they and their children, and bowed down. Leah likewise and her children drew near and bowed down. Finally, Joseph and Rachel drew near and they bowed down. Esau said, "What do you mean by all this company that I met?" Jacob answered, "To find favor with my Lord." But Esau said, "I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself." Jacob said, "No, please. If I find favor with you, then accept my present from my hand. But truly, to see your face is like seeing the face of God, since you have received me with such favor. Please accept my gift that is brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have everything he wants." So he urged him, and he took it. We've been talking all week about how Sachs is trying to use these stories to help us develop a theology of the other. And here we see this expression of a theology of the other, to see the face of God in the face of the other. Whether it is your biological brother, whether it is a neighbor who scares you, whether it is someone you have wronged. But you know, Gary keeps asking us what we need to do in the United States. I think what we learn from this story is we need to say, to come to terms with slavery, for example. And because I live in South Dakota, I always think, and to come to terms with the plight of Native Americans. which in some ways is worse than African Americans. And, well, we need to know it's going to hurt. We need to confront ourselves. And the interesting thing that happens then is that to go back to the two blessings is, which is the true blessing? That when Jacob becomes himself, he can be about his descendants and generosity and genuinely serving the other. But when he's pretending, he gets caught up into all these other kinds of things.
And this is repentance in a lot of ways.
It is repentance.
To turn.
And when we read the Joseph story on Friday, we're going to see a very graphic illustration of what repentance is. In case some of you, I know some of you are leaving. So the word for, the definition of description that's going to be given is to be put in the same circumstances and not act in the same way. That is genuine repentance. As opposed to Jacob, the earlier Jacob, who comes out of the womb grabbing, becomes an adult and grabs, is blessed by the father-in-law's household and is still grabbing, and then gets put in a new situation and does it differently. You know, shares what he has. And that happens in spades with Joseph's brothers. So that will be Friday's agenda. I mean, one of the things, I love the way Sachs put this. Jacob was wrong to seek Esau's blessing. In the wrestling match at night, Jacob fights not Esau, but himself in the presence of God. This is what he means when he says he has seen God face to face. Now he knows who he is. Not the man holding onto his brother's heel, but the man unafraid to wrestle with God and with man, because he has successfully wrestled with himself. Sibling rivalry is defeated the moment we discover that we are loved by God for what we are, not for what someone else is. We each have our own blessing. You know, there's been a voice in the room, I don't think she's here today, who talks about how it took her to adulthood to discover that the reason her sister could do things better than she is because her sister was a year older. By the time she was a year... Oh, you are here. Good. I mean, she could do that. And to discover that you are capable who you are and you have gifts and the other has gifts. And that this is blessed to be a blessing. Then. We're out of time. I'm willing to stay for a few more minutes. If you need to go, I certainly want to respect that. I mean, I think that we try to press this for interfaith implications. And the thing that this whole thing has set me thinking about is intra-faith implications. Which is to say, it's one thing to say we're willing to see neighbor in Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists and to learn from them, to be, I think it encourages us to be Christian in their presence. I don't think interfaith dialogue gets very far if we try to be sort of what we all have in common. Among college chaplains doing interfaith work, you will hear us say that interfaith never becomes more useless than when it's a bunch of disillusioned Christians trying to be something other than Christian. So be Christian and give Muslim and Buddhist neighbors the freedom to be Muslim and Buddhist and listen to one another. Trust that you are who you are. Bring this authenticity to it. But the interesting thing that happens is then you come back into a Christian community that may be suspect of you. I've witnessed that. And I told you, I got to hear Jonathan Sacks speak in New York City last time I was there. And one of the things that was really marvelous, there were a number of young Jewish adults in the room who said to Rabbi Sacks, they said, "We love what you're saying, but that's not what we're hearing from our rabbis." And he said, "Oh, I know from the rabbis they're hearing, you be true to your Jewish identity, and this is the way." And I mean, various forms of fundamentalism. In some ways, what we're working at here is how does fundamentalism break down? Well, it breaks down in our own heart. So I started yesterday saying proof texting is dangerous. The other thing I need is proof texting.
Oh, yeah.
So it's taking one verse out of the Bible and making it explain everything. The other thing we need to say about that is that we all do it. I mean, we all have our lens on the world. And until that lens is in a way broken open, poked, probably we will be stuck there. So what do you hear? What do you want to talk about? Or are you ready for coffee? I think to think about getting along with our siblings, it really has a lot to do with making peace with ourselves. Your brother's story. When your brother made peace with himself, he was totally different with you. And Gary, in one of his sessions, used the example of a dove, religion like a dove, needing to fly with two wings. One is the personal integration of faith, and the other is the social political justice implications of that, and the difficulty of bringing those together. I'll say more about that, I think, at the forum. Go ahead, John.
I find it much easier to talk to Muslims, Islam, he follows Islam, my Jewish friends, than I do a lot of my brothers and sisters in Christ. Mm. And that's that intra-faith. Yeah. I mean, that, and they're suspect of me because I've done that just like you, and I find that just so disheartening. Mm. And know my own role in that.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to sit down to a judgmental act with a judgmental action.
No.
Sorry, but I don't.
And you feel the judgment, even as you said.
Exactly.
I hear you being very self-critical.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing that makes interfaith the most challenging is that most interfaith discussion is among Christians, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, who are open to visiting with others.
Right.
So they have the whole openness thing in common.
Right.
And it's how to open up discussion with those who are not. One of the things I think I've learned as a campus pastor, because really, a lot of people come to a Christian college, a college that asserts a Christian value, with some variation of evangelical or fundamentalist assumptions. Whether they are in favor of that or against it, that's still sort of the definitive assumption. And one of the things I think I've learned is that the only way to move people out of that is to hear them out. Is to listen. It's very inefficient because it takes a lot of listening. But if you try to talk them out of it, you sound for all the world like another fundamentalist. And I honestly think that probably applies to Trump supporters too.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, the need to feel heard. I mean, we heard from a part of our neighborhood from which we've not heard. And I think one of the ways I feel most challenged, I love being at a place like Holden where I have the freedom to say this. I haven't had the courage to say this at Augustana yet, but the motto of Augustana is enter to learn, leave to serve. And I've wholeheartedly believed that we train our students to serve. I mean, that they go out with a vocation of service. And at the same time, the election forces me to recognize that we all benefit from being educated in the world, and well-educated and capable. And that from the point of view of other corners of our world, we are seen as self-serving, and education is seen as self-serving, even though I do think those corners of the world are blessed by our being educated.
Yeah.
I really do. And so how do we talk about the vocation of education to give the integrity of service, to help service have integrity for people who are not educated as well as other people who are? I just think that's a huge challenge. John?
I'm interested in this whole dialogue right now because, especially myself, where I'm going to college right now, like who I'm with and the groups I'm with are primarily evangelicals.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting to me because what the things you're saying right now are actually almost identical to the same things a lot of evangelical leaders are saying. But there's somehow some disconnect between how the two groups are interacting.
Right.
And it's very, because the view is, you know, like what you're saying about education, is a lot of evangelicals feel very well educated in a different way, and they have something to offer.
Mm-hmm.
And we have something to offer as well.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's interesting because it's so easy to get in our own heads and see it from our own perspective.
And in our own echo chambers.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, very important comment.
But it's, you know, this other group of people is actually, I think, thinking many of the same things we are, but through a different lens, and I think it's important for us to connect with that perspective.
Thank you. I mean, the thing that it causes me to think about is that yesterday we talked about this tension between cooperation and competition, that the same thing, namely groupishness, makes us cooperative and makes us competitive with other groups. And when you talk about educated in other ways, there is this relationship between clarity or certainty, I mean, academic validity, and ambiguity. And to hold those intentions, and some of us enter the certainty through ambiguity, and some of us enter ambiguity through the certainty, more or less, or we start in different places. But I love what you're saying, but there's a disconnect, and we're trying to figure that disconnect out. And I return where I began the very first day to say I'm just astonished that when the Bible talks about the disconnect, it talks about it between siblings. I would expect it to talk about it between armies or kings and queens or, you know, important, powerful people, but it doesn't. It talks about it in our families. Well, you've been very attentive. Oh, the prompt for tomorrow. Rachel and Leah. So, it says, so Jacob went into Rachel also, and he loved Rachel more than Leah. Another story. I mean, couldn't you tell it? Hallmark would never publish this. So the thing... The prompt I came up with is, what is your best in-law advice? Okay. So Ruth Bader Ginsburg is recorded on a series of the best advice you ever got, and she tells about her mother-in-law on her wedding day saying to her that the best advice she could give her for marriage is to pretend you didn't hear it. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you know, she's so wrong.
Yeah.
And so she says, it has been very good advice. I have used that advice in my marriage, and I have used it as a parent, and I have used it as a university professor, and I have used it on the United States Supreme Court. So what is your best in-law advice? You can give that some thought, and we'll see you tomorrow. Rachel and Leah.